I think that Giannis moving would be really interesting for the league. Superstars being dealt always shakes up the paradigm in the league. And I think as a sports fan, we deserve to see Giannis playing big games late in the season with other great players. All right. We move now into the second hour of our show. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to WMUC FM Radio on 90.5 here in College Park. It is 1 o'clock on a Tuesday, which means it is time for the second hour of Winning Time. I'm Jack Wynn, your host. We are going through all the best major sports topics of the week. It's your favorite sports talk show here in the DMV. We've got a big show for you. We closed out our first hour talking about the Bucks fielding offers for Giannis Antetokounmpo. We talked about the WNBA starting up. We discussed the NFL schedule release. And we talked about the biggest stories and takeaways from the NBA. But we're not done. We've got a lot more to go through. The NBA draft lottery was this week. We had some insane conversations and reports on sports television that we need to address. And half a dozen other sports had major headlines that we're going to need to go through. All of that after this quick message.
Ride my bike with no handlebars. No handlebars.
Sign up for the weekly bike rides every Tuesday around College Park. Don't have a bike? Just rent it from the campus bike shop. Spending time outdoors has great benefits. It raises your vitamin D levels, it improves concentration and focus, helps you recover from injury and stress, and it may even mean more smiles throughout the day. To get more information, log on to crs.umd/Maryland Adventure Program. Hashtag stay active.
I can tell you about Lee Erickson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American.
Speech problems. Who's got them? If you're worried about that class presentation, come on down to the Oral Communication Center, or OCC for short. We offer support for students who need help with their communication and public speaking skills. We're based in the Skinner Building in room 2117 from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. But if you need a little help in the afternoon, we're in McKeldin Library room 2111 after 4 p.m. Go to umd.mywconline.net to schedule an appointment, but walk-ins are always welcome. See you there.
All right, welcome back in. We have a lot to talk about. The NBA draft lottery was this past week, and we got some exciting results. Now, before we get to it, I want to talk about the concept of the draft lottery, because there's a lot of talk about how to change it, how to improve it, how to adjust it. The NBA has proposed half a dozen different rules and possible ways to fight against tanking, which is when teams are actively losing to try to improve their draft pick. And I think that this year's draft lottery results proved once again why the format is okay as is, why it doesn't need too much changing, because the lottery itself is already controversial. Now, how many times have we seen awful teams get screwed out of their draft pick or have one of the worst seasons in the league and end up with the fifth pick or the sixth pick? It happens a lot. And I get it. There are 82 games in a regular season. We have issues with load management, teams intentionally resting their best players. We have issues with small market teams, performing well on the national stage. We have issues with teams looking bad throughout the course of a season. All of this I understand. What do you think the Nets could have done this season to play better? Like, what do you think the Nets could have done this year to compete? I just don't. I have issues with fighting against tanking because you're only targeting the general managers of teams. The coaches and the players for every single team in the NBA are giving it 100% every single night. This is their jobs. This is their livelihood. For the players on these bad teams, who knows if they're going to get other chances to compete or to play in the NBA. They are giving it all they got. And so for the Brooklyn Nets to end up with the sixth pick, because this lottery system is supposed to prevent tanking, I just feel it's unfair. But you know what? Sure. See, Adam Silver, there's your evidence. Teams get punished for tanking. It's not a guarantee. And we have other teams that we're going to get to that have suffered the consequences of it this year. But the draft lottery is a chaotic system. It leads to a lot of odd scenarios playing out with draft picks, with trades, with everything. But that's just my little mini rant on the lottery as a whole. Now let's get into the actual results of how the ping pong balls came up. Starting off with the Washington Wizards, who absolutely should be celebrating today. All the Wizards fans I know are elated, and they absolutely deserve this. The Wizards have been one of the most dysfunctional and poorly run franchises of the last two decades. They've won less than 50 games combined over the last three seasons. They haven't had a star-level player since Bradley Beal left, and even when he was there, he was great at scoring and not really good at anything else, which means I would say they haven't had a real all-star since the Russell Westbrook days. And this is a team that struggled, but they've tried to do things the right way. And all of a sudden, everything is coming together a bit for Washington. Because when you're a team that stinks and you're cycling through the lottery year after year, the only thing you really can do is just collect good young players and good pieces. And that's what Washington's been doing. Because when it is time to compete, or when the lottery does turn up your way, you're going to have the right foundation to build around whoever your new superstar is. So, over the last few seasons, Washington has really started to build up this capital of good young depth guys. Bilal Coulibaly, great player. Keyshawn George. Alex Sarr, who is the best of all of them. He's a center. He averaged nearly 20 points this year. Bob Carrington, great pieces. Those are some really solid young guys that have been coming into their own. Trey Johnson, another great player. The Wizards have potential, and they have five or six different players who could really develop into solid rotational pieces for a team. And that doesn't even get in to the rest of this roster, because, as I mentioned, once you do finally think you're getting your superstar, you have the chips to cash in if you build your team the right way. And that's what Washington has been doing. What did they do during this year when they were struggling? Did they sit back and do nothing and just wait for the lottery? No. They went out and traded for Trae Young. They went out and traded for Anthony Davis. And so all of a sudden, Washington is going to turn around next year and have a really solid core. That starting five is going to be Trae Young, Keyonte George, A.J. DeBanza, Anthony Davis, and Alex Sarr. That's a very solid starting five, especially in an Eastern Conference, which is so top-heavy. I think the Wizards will be a playoff team next year. At the very least, they're going to be competing in the play-in. And that's more than any Wizards team can say for the last half decade. So I'm excited to see how the Wizards end up and how they turn it around. I do think there are still a lot of question marks, and if the Wizards are going to have the season that I think they might, they're going to have to find answers to those questions pretty quickly. First of all, is Anthony Davis going to be on the roster next year? There's a lot of debate about whether or not it's smarter to keep him or to trade him. And now that you have the first overall pick and you can take a player as talented as the guys that are available, maybe you move the old star to acquire more pieces and focus a little more long-term. Because if the Wizards are going to be, you know, live in the East this year, they're going to be doing it with a rookie being one of their best players. And so maybe you kind of extend this timeline a bit, trade Anthony Davis for other people who are more, you know, similar in age to some of these younger pieces and that are going to fit better and try to build a contender for a year or two from now. That's certainly an option. I would keep Anthony Davis, and I would try to just maximize what you can do with this roster. And I think the biggest question is Trae Young, because Trae is a very unique player. He's short, he's not great at defense, but he is remarkably talented as a playmaker. First of all, he can shoot from pretty much anywhere. He can score on a lot of different players in a lot of different ways, and he's a really great passer. And so what I want to see from Trae Young next year is to adjust his style of gameplay a bit. He's used to high volume, high offensive output, the ball in his hands almost all the time. I don't think that's conducive to winning basketball, because I think that Trae Young needs to take a bit of a step back on the scoring end and put a little more emphasis on the playmaking end. I'm not saying become a pure point guard and just look to distribute and set up plays. That's not getting the most out of Trae Young. He's too talented of an offensive player and as a shot maker to put him in that role. But making sure that he's looking to distribute more than he is to just get himself a bucket, that's helpful. Looking to throw lobs to Anthony Davis or Sar inside, which we know he can, that's helpful. Setting up some of the other guys and moving off ball to catch threes, that's something he can do as well. Those are all ways for a player like Trae Young to be more effective in the league. Because what we know about him is he's a great player that doesn't really know how to win. And this is a franchise that has a lot of talent that doesn't really know how to win. And if there's going to be a culture shift, they're going to need everybody to be a part of it, starting with Trae and AD. Next team I want to talk about is the Indiana Pacers, because they had a crazy scenario play out for them in this lottery. I guess it wasn't that crazy. It was decently, reasonably expectable, but I want to talk about it anyway. So the context for Indiana is they were playing in Game 7 of the NBA Finals last year, and they were a team that was better than a lot of the other teams in the Eastern Conference, and I thought were absolutely live to come back and compete again this year. Now, the thing is, Tyrese Halliburton got hurt early on in that game, and that completely derailed Indiana's chances for this upcoming season. And they knew it. They decided in the offseason that they were going to reset. They traded away some key players, Miles Turner. They traded him. And they knew that they were going to be bad this year. With that being said, their general manager still decided to take a risk and offer their first pick to the Los Angeles Clippers in exchange for Ivaka Zubac, who's a very solid center, and somebody who, when Tyrese Halliburton comes back next year, is going to play very well with and is going to fit well with schematically. The thing is, when they traded away the first pick, they only gave it a top four protection, which meant that in exchange for Zubac, the Pacers had about a 50-50 chance to retain their pick. If the Pacers picked 1, 2, 3, or 4, they would have the center and the pick. Got it? Okay. Pacers come up fifth. Means that despite the terrible season they had, despite Halliburton being out all year, they don't get any compensation for it. And they instead are going to be pickless. And we got a bit of an apology from the Pacers general manager, basically being like, look, I'm sorry, fans. We took a risk. We know that this team needs a center so that when our best player comes back next year, we can really compete. I was hoping that we would still get lucky in the draft anyway and end up keeping the pick, but just didn't work out that way. Now, some people were upset with this tweet because, you know, he was kind of admitting that they were expecting to do poorly. But I have no issue with it. What else were the Pacers supposed to do? They were in Game 7 of the Finals. You can't really compete much harder than that. And when you lose your best players and you retool a roster, you're going to be bad. And this general manager took a big risk with this trade because a top four pick is immensely valuable in this year's draft. And missing out on it is going to hurt. The Clippers end up with the fifth pick. They're going to get a very solid player. They're an organization that I have no idea what's happening with the Clippers, honestly. But for the Pacers, they'll be back next year. In their mind, I'm sure they'll just think of it as, we drafted Zubac with the fifth pick. Let's just think of it like that. Next, the Memphis Grizzlies. I want to touch on them real quick, because I was happy that they moved up into the top three. They're going to have to rebuild. And this is a team that was exciting and scrappy a few years ago with John Morant, Jaren Jackson Jr., Dylan Brooks, all those guys. And it's just really come apart for them a bit at the seams here over this last, you know, half decade of basketball. I expect Ja to be on the move next year. They already traded Triple J. I think Memphis is just clearly rebuilding. Now that you have the third pick, I think you can build around whoever you take. There are three guys in this year's class who would be on par with a lot of the other number one picks of past drafts. So Memphis is going to get a stud. They're going to get a future superstar. And hopefully this can help reset that organization and move them along a bit. So I want to do a quick mock draft of that top three. First of all, I think the Wizards are going to take A.J. DeBanza, the point forward. I think he's a really talented player. He can do a lot. He can play make. He can shoot. He can get inside. He can defend. He's just a really great all-around player. That's something that the Wizards really need. If you look at some of the young guys I was talking about earlier, the way that roster's set up, they could really use a scoring, defending, playmaking wing, which is exactly what DeBanza is. I think he's going to develop into a superstar after a few years in this league. I think it'll be obvious early on that he's an effective player. And similarly to how we saw Cooper Flagg playing with Anthony Davis earlier this year, and Flagg was playing really well, and it was clear he's going to develop into a star, I think that's what we're going to get with AJ. I think he's not going to necessarily be the best player on the floor, but it's clear that he's going to be the best player on the floor eventually. Darren Peterson, the guard from Kansas, I think he's headed to Utah with the second pick. And I think the Jazz are just going to have to build around him. They don't really have a ton of other great pieces. They've got some good guys who are going to be able to, you know, show Peterson the ropes a bit, and they're not just going to be dead in the water. I mean, they've got some talent over out there in Utah, but the Jazz have been struggling for years. Danny Ainge has been collecting draft picks to build around a star, and now they finally have him. Darren Peterson's a very talented player. He was hurt, by the way, banged up for a lot of last year. People were expecting him to be a little better coming out of college than maybe he was, but despite the fact that he was a touch underwhelming, he is still going to be the second pick and still going to be a franchise-changing player for the Jazz. And then the third pick, Cam Boozer. I think that he is going to go to Memphis. I think he is going to be a very similar stylistic player to a guy like Paolo Banchero out in Orlando. I think Boozer is going to be the face of this Grizzlies team going forwards in that franchise. I think he's a good defender. He's a physical player. He gets inside, can shoot it a little bit. I don't know necessarily that he is going to develop into someone who can be the best player on a champion, but I think he is going to be a star, all-star in this league very quickly. And he is going to get a lot of usage in Memphis because after they tear things down as I expect them to, like I said, I think this team needs a rebuild. They could use a reset, a lot better pieces around him. I think Boozer is going to be the main guy down there. And as he develops, he's going to be the one with the ball in his hands. So I think it'll be interesting to see it play out. Three guys who in a lot of other drafts would be the number one pick. So a huge chunk of talent being infused into the league this upcoming offseason. I'm excited to see how it plays out. And these bad teams, they deserve it. They've earned it. I'm very happy for Washington. Very happy for Utah. Very happy for Memphis. All right, we're going to take another quick break. When we come back, we are going to talk about one of the more interesting sports stories throughout the national media right after this.
Are you looking for a club that celebrates friendship? Then Best Buddies might be the one for you. We organize social events for local folks with disabilities to come to campus and hang out. Some of our highlights of the past years have been our holiday parties, a polar bear plunge in the freezing Chesapeake Bay, our friendship walk with Best Buddies branches from around the state, and a winter formal with over 80 people. And if you want to learn more information, check out our Instagram at BestBuddiesUMD.
I can ride my bike with no handlebars, no handlebars.
Sign up for the weekly bike rides every Tuesday around College Park. Don't have a bike? Just rent it from the campus bike shop. Spending time outdoors has great benefits. It raises your vitamin D levels, it improves concentration and focus, helps you recover from injury and stress, and it may even mean more smiles throughout the day. To get more information, log on to crs.umd/Maryland Adventure Program. Hashtag stay active.
I can tell you about Leif Erickson. I know all the words to De Colores, and I'm proud to be an American. Me and my friends.
Ever wonder why you feel like a complete zombie when your alarm goes off after 8 hours, if you're even lucky enough to get that much sleep? As college students, it feels almost impossible for us to get enough sleep. We're constantly told to get 8 hours, but is that really the magic number? Did you know that throughout the night, your body cycles through periods of light sleep and very deep sleep? Most people's sleep cycles tend to last 90 minutes, so if you aim for 8 hours, your alarm is likely to go off just as you're diving into deeper sleep. Try aiming for 7.5 hours of sleep and see how you feel in the morning. If you feel great, you probably nailed it and found your sleep cycle. If you don't feel perfect just yet, test out an 85 or 95 minute sleep cycle instead. Not only will you feel great in the mornings once you discover your magic number, you'll also add about 30 minutes of valuable time to your day.
All right, welcome back in. If you're just tuning in, you are listening to Winning Time on WMUC FM Radio here in College Park on 90.5. I'm Jack Wynn, hosting your favorite sports talk show here in the DMV area. Now, we had quite the fascinating, I'm almost going to describe it as an event, take place this past Friday, where two legends in the field of sports broadcast media reunited. I'm talking, of course, about Stephen A. Smith and Skip Bayless, two people who are known for their extreme takes, their intense debate, and their high controversial conversations. So Skip and Stephen A. reunited after nearly 10 years apart. Skip was on First Take with Stephen A. until 2016, where he moved to Fox Sports and started up the show Undisputed. That show eventually fizzled out. Skip has done some podcast stuff, all while Stephen A. has stayed on ESPN. And now we got, as fans, a chance to see them go head-to-head and debate one more time. It was really fun. It was really entertaining. And although a lot of people don't like Skip or Stephen A., you have to admit that they have done a lot of work for the industry of sports media and sports television. The sports shows that you watch on TV today would not be the same without either of them. They're highly influential, and they absolutely deserve respect and credit where it's due. With that being said, it doesn't make the actual things that they talk about or the takes that they provide any more reasonable. And the most famous one, and the one that went viral, was Skip Bayless defending his claim that LeBron James is the 9th greatest player in the history of the NBA. 9th. The great LeBron James. Now, Before I get to my own list, I want to talk about the absurdity of some of Skip Bayless's claims. First of all, the thing that he loves to keep going back to with LeBron is the fact that he shrinks in big moments and is lost in the finals. Well, let's talk about some of those moments that he's shrunk in. First of all, 2007, he got swept by the Spurs in the finals. Did he? Sure. He was also 22. It was his first ever major playoff run, and he was taking on one of the greatest teams in NBA history, who, after the game, everybody on that roster said LeBron was the best player in the world and that they had to guard him with all five players on the court to stop him. Okay. Not sure we can really put that one on LeBron, but all right. How about, you know, those Eastern Conference Finals runs where he lost to Orlando and then to Boston before leaving for Miami and, you know, quitting on his team? Well, his second best player on both of those teams was Boobie Gibson and Zydrunas Ilgauskas. If you're asking who those people are, yeah, you're supposed to be. LeBron was doing this on his own. He was 24 and 25 years old. And he was getting to conference finals, hitting game winners, scoring at unbelievable volumes, and forcing super teams like Boston to defeat him while he was all on his own. So I don't think that's necessarily fair either. 2011, sure. That's one of the worst series that a superstar has ever played. And LeBron absolutely shrunk in the moment. But it happens once to every great player. Jordan had the ball stolen from him against the Magic. He also got swept multiple times early on in his career. Kobe had the air balls against Phoenix. Curry had the blown 3-1 lead against OKC. Everybody has those series. But to act like the other times LeBron lost against the Spurs, against the Warriors, against Boston, are because he shrunk when he's averaging like 30 points, 7 rebounds, and 7 assists in those series, it's not fair. And it's disingenuous. Skip likes to talk about LeBron at the late game free throw line. Okay, well, in 2016 in the finals, when he had a chance to ice the comeback, or to ice the game and the greatest comeback of all time at the free throw line, he hit it. And then again, in 2013, after the Heat came back, he hit two free throws to clinch the win against the Spurs. Sure, he's not a great free throw shooter, but you can't have guys like Shaq and Kareem over LeBron all time and point to free throws as reasoning. And lastly, he says LeBron's not clutch, which is the most egregious take that you could have, because LeBron might just be the most clutch player in NBA history. He's got more game-winning playoff buzzer beaters than any player ever. He's got more than Jordan and Kobe combined. He's got more game winners. He shoots a higher percentage in the last 10 seconds, in the last 24 seconds of a game, and in the last minute. He has the most points per game in elimination game history. LeBron is clutch. That is undisputable. And so we can acknowledge the absurdity of some of these takes, but it doesn't get you anywhere if you don't then reframe them into a better take. Well, while I just disproved everything about Skip Bayless's list, an issue with LeBron, I'm going to give you my personal top 10 NBA players of all time. And this is a list that I've had pretty stable for a while. And it's because there are only really 12 select players you can pick from. There are 12 guys in NBA history who you can fairly argue are top 10. And so we'll start with my two honorable mentions, the guys who just missed the cut, Hakeem Olajuwon and Wilt Chamberlain. For Hakeem, that one wasn't so hard to put him at 12. He's an unbelievable player, one of the greatest defenders we've ever seen. Won back-to-back titles in the year Jordan was retired and the year Jordan came back. Averaged nearly 30 and 12 for a decade in the playoffs. Historically great player for sure. Hakeem Olajuwon deserves all the accolades. But he's not better than some of these other guys. Wilt Chamberlain. I have him at 11. He is also an honorable mention, although I suppose if I rank them 12 and 11, this kind of just makes it a top 12 list. Wilt won four MVPs He won two championships. He averaged 50 points per game in a season. He averaged 48.5 minutes per game in a season. Keep in mind, there are only 48 minutes in a game. So he was playing every minute and then all the overtime minutes as well. He is one of the all-time leading rebounders, one of the all-time leading scorers. He led the league in assists as a center. Wilt Chamberlain was an absolute demon and a freak in the 60s and early 70s. Teams were asking him to come out of retirement when he was in his 40s. So the reason I don't have Wilt in the top 10 is because him and Hakeem, they only have two rings. They're both great, unstoppable, historically dominant players. But all the guys I've got ahead of them have at least three rings. And when it's really that dicey, you have to kind of pick and choose. You have to nitpick a bit. Wilt didn't win till later in his career when he had the offensive output wasn't as impressive. Hakeem Olajuwon won when Michael Jordan wasn't really as prominent in the league, so that's something you have to consider. Whatever. Now let's get into the actual top 10. Number 10, I've got Shaquille O'Neal. One of the most dominant players of all time. At his peak, Shaq might be the best. It's hard to find someone as unstoppable as Shaq was in the early 2000s with those Lakers teams. In the NBA Finals, in which they three-peated and he won three straight Finals MVPs, he averaged over 30, 12, and 3 in the three playoff runs. Just an unstoppable force. With Orlando, he was competitive, even took down Michael Jordan in the playoff series. Meeting up with Kobe, being that best player for a while, winning another title with Dwayne Wade, with the Heat after leaving the Lakers. Shaq is an unstoppable player on offense and defense. The reason I've got him down at 10 is because his prime could have lasted longer if he was willing to commit more to the game of basketball, put more work in, but Shaq deserves to be top 10. Number 9, Larry Bird. Three championships, three straight MVPs in the 80s. One of the first volume three-point shooters that we ever saw. One of the most dangerous playmakers in league history. Not to mention, he would trash talk the heck out of you. He was an imposing player mentally and physically. He was not scared of anybody. He won, as I mentioned, three titles, battled against Magic Johnson and the Showtime Lakers for an entire decade. Larry Bird is one of the best players ever. He deserves to be ninth. Again, I don't have him higher than that right now because he had to retire a bit early with back issues. Didn't really sustain that greatness for as long as he could have, but in the 10, 12 years he played, he was an absolutely dominant force. At number 8, this is a recent movement on my list. I've got Stephen Curry. Steph has really ascended these all-time lists over the last 5 years. And he put himself in this group when he won that first title without KD. He is a four-time champion. He won a Finals MVP. He is the all-time leader in three-pointers made, but that doesn't even do his shooting justice. He's the greatest shooter of all time by a wide margin. He has set records that will likely never be broken. And the biggest thing for me, the reason why, because I used to have Steph towards the bottom of this group. I thought he deserved to be in it, but I thought he was towards the bottom. And now I'm moving him up a little higher towards the middle because I'm recognizing just how significant Stephen Curry is in the history of sports. He has completely changed the way that the basketball is played and that the way the NBA is played. Teams, I'll put it this way. Every single team in the league this season shot more threes per game than the 2016 Warriors did. So we have seen an unprecedented and extreme growth in three-point shooting, in spacing, in how you prioritize outside play, and that is all because of Steph Curry. You could not keep up or compete with the Warriors and Curry if you didn't play that style. And so that kind of impact is legendary stuff. What he did in the Olympics is legendary stuff. Making an All-NBA team at 36 is legendary stuff. Stephen Curry is clearly one of the 10 greatest players of all time. He is a bit of a question mark defensively, which is what has, you know, also kept him a little lower for me. But his impact, his two MVPs, one of them being unanimous, the four titles, elevates him to number eight all time. Number seven, Kobe Bryant. Five rings, a league MVP, a three-peat, a back-to-back. There's a lot you can say about Kobe. But the biggest thing you can say is that he was as committed to basketball as anybody ever. His mentality, his focus, and his drive were unprecedented. And his commitment to getting better is something that should be studied by individuals, not just athletes in pro sports, but by anybody who has a goal they want to accomplish. You can be inspired by the work and determination that Kobe Bryant provided. Some people will think this is too low. Some people will think this is too high, which is why I feel like it's probably a solid place for Kobe to be. Five championships is really impressive. After that first one with Shaq, he was almost as good as Shaq was in his prime those early years. So he is the second best shooting guard of all time. He plays very similarly stylistically to Michael Jordan. Great shot making, contested shot making, incredibly clutch player. Had some issues in the playoffs early on, but then after Shaq left, turned it around, won two more rings with Pau Gasol. 60 points in his last game. So many legendary things to say about Kobe Bean Bryant. I've got him seven all time. Six, Tim Duncan. He would have six rings if it weren't for Ray Allen. But instead, he's got five. He's got a couple league MVPs. He's the greatest power forward that we've ever seen. And the him versus Kobe debate is a fascinating one because they both got five rings, the MVP, sustained greatness. They both retired in 2016, played a long time. But the reason that I have become somebody who's got Duncan higher is because the Spurs were winning titles and dominant from 1999 until 2015. And Tim Duncan was the best player the entire way through. You can argue David Robinson was better really early on when Duncan was like a rookie, but it was clear that it was not that much of a disparity and Duncan became the main guy very quickly. Kobe, meanwhile, had Shaq for three of those titles. Duncan had to do it on his own for at least four of them, made another championship. And he is also one of the best defenders we've ever seen. He is one of the most sound, quiet players in terms of leadership and locker room presence. You're not going to get any drama from Tim Duncan ever. And his ability to be stable, to provide the Spurs with consistency, both on offense, on defense, inside the paint, makes him a top six player of all time. All right, that brings us to our top five. I already think this list is better than Skip's, by the way. I hope that you agree. When I look at my top five all time, I see five players who dominated an entire decade. And that, essentially, is my reasoning for putting them top five. All the guys below them had great stretches or were really good in bursts. For example, Kobe and Duncan shared the role as being the best players of the 2000s. Stephen Curry wasn't the best player of the 2010s, but was really effective. Bird shared it with Magic. Wilt wasn't the best player of his run. Hakeem wasn't the best player of the 90s, but they were all incredibly effective, and if it weren't for these five guys, any one of them could be maybe the greatest ever. But let's start with the people who were actually able to accomplish it. Starting off at number five is Magic Johnson. Five championships. One of the all-time leaders in assists. One of the greatest playmakers we've ever seen. The greatest passer we've ever seen. The leader of the Showtime Lakers in the 1980s. Magic saved the NBA. Before Magic came into the NBA, the league was starting to die. the 70s were really bad for the league. The ratings were starting to fall off. There were issues with investing in the players. And a rival league called the ABA was giving the NBA real trouble. Bring in Magic Johnson. All of a sudden, this smiley, tall, fast, entertaining point guard heads to Hollywood and LA and completely reshapes the way that we view the league. Magic Johnson, in his first season, closed out the NBA Finals by playing center, where he dropped a 40-point double-double. He is a legendary player. He won 5 rings, multiple MVPs throughout the 80s. He only played 12 healthy seasons before his HIV diagnosis and he had to retire. In those 12 years, he was 9-time first-team All-NBA. He made 9 finals, and he was a top-5 MVP finisher 9 times. Just consistency, dominance, and some of the best stretch of basketball we've ever seen. That's 5. Number 4, Bill Russell. If you know about Bill Russell, you'll understand this. If you don't, you'll think that this is an absurd take. Bill Russell only averaged 16 points per game in his career. He was surrounded by nearly a dozen other Hall of Famers, and he played in an era where there were just 8 teams. And despite that, Bill Russell deserves to be a top 5 player ever. Sure, they were playing the same 8 teams every night, but you know what that means? It means every night he was taking on Bob Pettit or Wilt Chamberlain or Elgin Baylor or Jerry West or any of these other historically great players. Less teams in the league means all the best players are more concentrated. Not to mention, he is the greatest defender in the history of the sport. He quite literally invented jumping for the block. He was an Olympic-level jumper who played in the NBA. He won 8 straight championships, 11 rings, 5 league MVPs. And if they had Defensive Player of the Year awards back then, who knows what he could have accomplished. They literally invented the finals MVP trophy because of him, because of how dominant he was. Not to mention, as soon as he retired, he turned around and won another ring as a coach. So you want to talk about leadership? You want to talk about knowing the game? You want to talk about dominance? Bill Russell is your guy. Number 3, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. The greatest center ever. Played for over 20 years. Won championships in the 70s. Won championships in the late 80s. The oldest finals MVP of all time. Was the all-time leading scorer until LeBron passed him. One of the best defenders we've seen. The skyhook is an unstoppable shot that nobody's been able to really replicate. And his sustained dominance, his 6 league MVPs, and his plethora of records and awards and winning makes him the 3rd greatest player ever. And that leaves the top 2. Skip Bayless has LeBron James as the 9th greatest player of all time. He thinks it's asinine to compare him to Michael Jordan. Well, not only am I going to compare him to Michael Jordan, I'm going to say he's better. I've got LeBron as the greatest player in the history of basketball, and Michael Jordan at number 2. Now, Michael Jordan is the greatest scorer we've ever seen. He three-peated twice. He was great in the 90s. One of the best defensive guards we've ever seen in the league. But what LeBron James has accomplished simply puts him on another level. Sure, Jordan's a better scorer than LeBron, I suppose. Okay, well, LeBron has 10,000 more points scored in his career than MJ does. All right? Well, is MJ a better passer? No, LeBron's one of the best passers ever. He's actually 2nd all-time in assists. All right, well, Jordan's got to be a more versatile defender, right? No, actually. Is Jordan a better perimeter defender? Sure, but LeBron can guard all 5 positions. This postseason, we've seen him guard Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and Alperen Şengün. We have seen him in his career guard Derrick Rose, Steph Curry, and Nikola Jokic. He can guard 1 through 5. He's a versatile guy. All right, well, surely Jordan's at least more athletic, right? Well, I don't know. That's probably a wash. All right, well, LeBron's had way more help throughout his career? No, not really. there's really not many arguments for why Jordan's better all time. LeBron is, at this point, a more accomplished scorer. He's a better passer, a better rebounder, a more versatile defender. He's better off the court. You're never going to see stories about LeBron gambling until 5 in the morning the night before a playoff game. You're never going to see stories about LeBron quitting the game of basketball 3 different times as he retires to go play another sport and then come back. You're never going to hear stories about LeBron getting swept in the first round multiple years in a row. Those are all things that have happened to Michael Jordan. LeBron is a better, more overall well-rounded player. He has one of the highest IQs of anybody we've ever seen. He has 40,000 career points, 10,000 career assists, 10,000 career rebounds, which are numbers nobody else has even come close to. He's just the greatest player we've ever seen. And I don't understand ranking him at 9. Sorry, Skip Bayless. Your list stinks. Okay, that's my all-time top 10. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're heading up a segment that I like to call News Around the Block, where we're going to check out a few different storylines and a few different sports, go through them, and then we'll start to wrap up our show with just under 15 minutes left here in the second hour. We'll be right back with you after this.
Speech problems. Who's got them? If you're worried about that class presentation, come on down to the Oral Communication Center, or OCC for short. We offer support for students who need help with their communication and public speaking skills. We're based in the Skinner Building in room 2117 from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. But if you need a little help in the afternoon, we're in McKeldin Library room 2111 after 4 p.m. Go to umd.mywconline.net to schedule an appointment, but walk-ins are always welcome. See you there.
Neuropsychiatric disorders are one of the leading causes of disability in young people around the world, and TERPs are no exception. 1 out of 3 TERPs will feel depressed at one point during the semester. You are not alone if you are feeling down. Here at Maryland, you can talk it out with fellow students who are going through the same problems in group therapy sessions, or even have a one-on-one therapy session with one of our many experienced therapists. The campus mental health center is open from 8:30 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you or someone you know needs help, come visit the health center and be a healthier TERP.
Ever wonder why you feel like a complete zombie when your alarm goes off after 8 hours, if you're even lucky enough to get that much sleep? As college students, it feels almost impossible for us to get enough sleep. We're constantly told to get 8 hours, but is that really the magic number? Did you know that throughout the night, your body cycles through periods of light sleep and very deep sleep? Most people's sleep cycles tend to last 90 minutes, so if you aim for 8 hours, your alarm is likely to go off just as you're diving into deeper sleep. Try aiming for 7.5 hours of sleep and see how you feel in the morning. If you feel great, you probably nailed it and found your sleep cycle. If you don't feel perfect just yet, test out an 85 or 95 minute sleep cycle instead. Not only will you feel great in the mornings once you discover your magic number, you'll also add about 30 minutes of valuable time to your day.
All right, welcome back in. We've got a few quick segments to go through. We've got a little over 10 minutes left here in the second hour of our show. So we're going to hit up News Around the Block. We're going to take a stroll to a few different sports and talk about some of the major stories that have played out. Starting back in the NBA, we're talking about the Cleveland Cavaliers, who picked up a big win in Game 4 over Detroit to tie the series at 2-2. And that win came on the back of James Harden, who had his kind of, you know, once a series, very good performance. And he had a comment afterwards talking about he doesn't listen to the chatter, about his playoff performances, about his expectations, whatever. This was a big win because if you lose you're headed back to Detroit down 3-1, which is a really hard spot to be in, and you probably get closed out in 5 games. However, they were able to come through. Harden dropped 27 points, 11 assists, was very effective down the stretch, and it's a reminder that James Harden is capable of playing well in the playoffs at points. It is just one of the saddest facts about his career that he can't do it consistently. James Harden, for a while, was a top 5 player in the league, was a league MVP, was one of the best players in basketball, and year after year after year, he shrunk in the playoffs. He just had a big game 4. I don't know if he'll have another big game this series, but what I do know is whenever Cleveland loses, he is going to be the one who played terribly. He's probably going to have another game with more fouls or turnovers than he had made baskets, which he's already had 3 times these playoffs. So I'm happy for James Harden because he had a good performance. If you're a Cavaliers fan, don't get used to it. I wouldn't expect it to be a consistent thing. For Detroit, they are now in an interesting situation because they are going to have to play a tough series against Cleveland before going on to take on the Knicks. Cade Cunningham had his worst game of the series, of the playoffs, in fact. 19 points, 7 of 16 from the field, just 3 rebounds and 6 assists and 5 turnovers to go along with it. Cade Cunningham, by the way, minus 23 in this game against Cleveland. So just not a very effective player. I expect him to be much better in Game 5. I think that Detroit probably finishes out this series in 6. But at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if it goes 7. If Detroit wins one more, maybe we see another Harden game. Maybe we see a big Mitchell game. But once the pressure starts to really rise, I think Detroit's going to close it out. After that rough start to the playoffs, they've shown that they can get through adversity and that they understand how to win, and I think that they'll prove exactly that. Next, the Colorado Avalanche go up 3-1 themselves after a back-and-forth game against the Wild. That one was fun. The Wild were up 1-0, then it was 2-1, and then the Avalanche went up 3-2 with 8 minutes left, and then they had 2 empty netters to close out the game, make it look like a blowout. Final score was 5-2, but obviously it was closer than it seemed. And this is just continued dominance from the Avalanche, a team that has been so good this entire NHL season. They finished the year with over 120 points. They were unstoppable in round one of the playoffs, and now I fully expect them to continue on this run, probably to close out Game 5 themselves and then sit waiting in the Stanley Cup Finals for whoever comes to face them. I think that they could beat any team left. I think that they'll beat the Golden Knights. They could beat the Ducks. This is just, you know, this Avalanche team has really learned how to play well together, how to play fast. They get in and out of their sets quickly. They've got their rotations really well established at this point, to the extent where they can kind of beat you no matter who's out there on the floor. They're really well coached, and I think that's what makes this such a dangerous team. I don't know how a team is going to beat them. The Wild have played them close a couple of times, but the Avalanche just managed to pull through every single time because they're that good. And I'm proud of my prediction. It wasn't necessarily a hot take to say they were going to go on to win the Stanley Cup Final, but it certainly looks like they're trending that way. Next, golf. Christopher Reaton won the Truist Championship this past weekend. He finished 15 under par to win by 2 strokes. Ricky Fowler almost had him. It was close at a couple of moments there. Towards the end, it was a little dicey, but Reaton handled it, got his first win, his first PGA Tour title. And I thought this was an incredible story because, as I mentioned, he did just win his first PGA Tour title. It's an incredible accomplishment, the Truist Championship, especially doing so 15 under and winning by 2 strokes. But he almost gave up on golf. He was struggling to find success in this field and in the sport, and he considered bailing to YouTube to become one of the guys you'll see on YouTube who have a career just playing golf for entertainment. Instead, he turned it around, he locked in, he chased his dream, and he is now a champion. It's a great story. It's really exciting. It's inspirational for fans. And I'm really happy it played out that way. All right. We've got about 5 minutes left here in our show. We're going to take one quick 30-second break, and then we're going to end off by talking about the matchups that I'm most excited to see in the NFL when the schedule gets released this week. With you after this.
The Campus Pantry is a free resource available for all UMD students, faculty, and staff experiencing food insecurity. It is open 5 days a week from 10 to 5 and is located on the ground floor of the South Campus Dining Building, next to the Common Shop. You must swipe your university ID before entering and check out before leaving. Make sure to bring your own reusable bag. For more information, you can visit the UMD Campus Pantry website at campuspantry.umd.edu. That's campuspantry.umd.edu.
All right, welcome back in. We've got about a little under 5 minutes left here in our show, and we are going to go through my top five matchups in the NFL that I'm most excited to see. If you're not aware, the schedule for the season is being released in the next few days. We've already gotten a few leaks coming out. We heard about the Giants-Cowboys matchup. We heard about Bills-Lions, which is going to be on Thursday Night Football in Week 2. But we know the games that are going to be played because they go on a rotation. You have to play, you know, every team every few years. That's just how it works. What we don't know is the order. So I'm going to talk about the matchups I'm most excited for, and we'll have to see where they come up during the regular season. So starting off at number 5 is the Titans at the New York Giants. And I have a little personal bias for this one as a Giants fan, but these two teams and franchises and fan bases have been kind of scrappy over the last year. The Titans drafted Cam Ward first overall. The Giants took their quarterback, Jackson Dart, later in the first round. There's been a lot of discourse over which quarterback had the better rookie season, who's got the better future. Not to mention, the Titans just hired former Giants coach Brian Daboll as their offensive coordinator, so it's a bit of a revenge game. I think that there's a lot of excitement there. There's going to be a lot of buildup between the two fan bases before that game. Whenever it happens, make sure you keep an eye on it. Number 4, the Las Vegas Raiders at the Kansas City Chiefs. I want to see Fernando Mendoza go to Arrowhead. There are going to be a lot of great games involving Mahomes this season, but I'm somebody who believes in Fernando Mendoza, who thinks that he's going to change the course of this Raiders franchise and their culture. Mahomes has always beat up on the Raiders. I would like to see Mendoza go into Arrowhead and at least compete. There's a chance that this game that I have 4th on my list is a total blowout and the Chiefs just annihilate Las Vegas. But if not, I think it could be a really big deal for Mendoza and his future in the league. Number 3, the Baltimore Ravens at the Buffalo Bills. This one is just always entertaining. It's two teams and two quarterbacks who are always competing in the AFC, who have gotten close and banged on the door to make the Super Bowl and haven't gotten there. Josh Allen and Lamar Jackson, incredibly talented players. They bring the entertainment. It's electric every single time. It's always a close game. I'm excited to see that one. Not to mention, both teams, after a long time, fired their head coaches. So how those new systems look, I think will be interesting to see. Number 2, Patriots at Chiefs. This one I think is going to be fun. The AFC defending champions, New England, head to Arrowhead to take on the team that has been dominant in the AFC for the last decade. How does Drake May play against a healthy Mahomes? I don't know. How do these two teams match up? Are the Chiefs ready to re-announce themselves as the dominant force in the conference? That's something that we'll find out when these two teams meet up. I expect it to be on primetime in the middle or late in the year. And lastly, the matchup I'm most excited to see is kind of two matchups because it's the Seahawks and the Rams. They're going to play each other twice, once in Seattle, once in LA. Both matchups are going to be great. Both were absolute cinema last season. I cannot wait to see them play out. The defending champion, Seattle Seahawks. I wouldn't be surprised, by the way, if that was one of the games that kicked off the season on Thursday Night Football opening night. These are two teams that battled in the conference championship, proved they were super close. I can't wait to see how they match up against each other next year. and what we've learned about how they've improved. All right. That is our show. Thank you for listening. I'm already excited for my last episode.